Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. For some people, credit card debt is just a matter of convenience, but for others, it is literally an addiction.
I was $40,000 in debt on credit cards when I got to DA, and I still had $35,000 in credit left.
That's DA for Debtors Anonymous, and we'll hear how the program has turned lives around. Plus, call them millennials, call them Gen Y, but it may be time to stop calling people in their 20s the entitlement generation.
Am I going to go to my boss and say, you know, add an extra week's vacation, I need, you know, a raise? And no.
And it's been 4 years since New Orleans flooded after Hurricane Katrina. I'll check in with one couple who rebuilt right by a levee break and find out how they paid for it.
We still have credit card debt that we never carried before, hoping that this additional money will come.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. We are finally starting to reach for our wallets again. The government reports that personal spending rose 0.2% last month. Not much, but more than we've been doing. Unfortunately, though, our incomes are not rising. In fact, they stayed flat. And this week, seniors found out their income is going to stay that way. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
Expecting a big fat raise this year? Okay, you can stop laughing. I get it. You are not all CEOs. Given the way things are, most people aren't even thinking about the possibility of more green in their bank accounts. But if you're a senior collecting Social Security, not only were you thinking about it, you probably were counting on it. That is until Social Security officials announced this week that for the first time in more than 30 years, seniors will not get cost of living increases, often referred to as COLA. From Washington, Tamara Keith has more.
Social Security payments normally increase a little bit every year. That's because the payments are tied to the Consumer Price Index. The CPI measures the cost of things like food and gas and other consumer goods. Thanks to the recession and the dramatic drop in gas prices, the CPI is down. So next year, Social Security payments are expected to stay right where they are.
I'm not an economist, but I'm sorry, that just doesn't cut it with me.
Barbara LaBelle is 67 years old. She's retired, lives in Michigan, and relies almost entirely on her $900 a month Social Security check. She says her personal consumer price index hasn't come down.
I go to the grocery store and the prices haven't decreased. The prices have gone up. Everything goes up in price, but my Social Security doesn't go up.
And LaBelle says she's paying more for health care. Her co-payments have gone up, so she's spending as much on health care every month as she is on rent. Her experience is common for many seniors. Health care costs are rising a lot faster than the rate of inflation. Barbara Canelli is president of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. She says health care costs are factored into the CPI, but they're based on the average American. And seniors spend a lot more on health care than the average American.
That's why seniors get hurt by not having a COLA, because their basic expense other than their rent or their mortgage is health care.
Seniors who have been counting on extra income from their 401ks or equity in their homes have seen their nest egg shrink. Take Minnesota retiree Douglas Augustine. He's rationing his retirement savings and relying more heavily on a Social Security check.
I am not living high on the hog.
Augustine says his only indulgences are his pets and the occasional fishing trip.
I think I've been to 2 movies in 2 years, and I don't eat out much, although I might grab, you know, something like a Taco Bell where you can get a 69-cent taco.
Social Security advocate Barbara Canelli and groups like the AARP want Congress to either give seniors a small lump sum or approve a cost of living increase, even though the Social Security funding formula doesn't call for it. But not everyone is convinced that seniors are worse off. Jagadish Gokhale is a senior fellow at the conservative Cato Institute.
On net, I think retirees are coming out ahead.
He points out Social Security recipients got a nearly 6% cost of living increase earlier this year, and prices on many consumer goods have dropped.
We hear a lot about the seniors' plight because their lobbies are much more organized. They're much more organized and more vocal about their problems.
But that doesn't mean Congress will be listening when it returns from recess. Lawmakers already have a lot of pressing and pricey matters on their to-do list, like a health care overhaul. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Much has been made of the jump in the savings rate in the years since the financial crisis hit. We're now setting aside about 5% instead of the less than zero of a couple of years ago. We're also trying to shed debt, and different methods work for different people. Maybe you have a financial advisor helping sort things out, or maybe you're an adherent of Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover. Well, here at Marketplace Money, we figure whatever works for you, go for it. So today we're highlighting another method used by thousands of people across the country. Debtors Anonymous started in 1968 as an outgrowth of Alcoholics Anonymous. In today's show, we'll hear from three DA members here in Los Angeles. We're honoring their requests to use first names only.
I'm Joe. I've been a member of Debtors Anonymous for, it'll be 10 years, August 15th.
I met up with Joe a few weeks ago at the Getty Museum in West Los Angeles. It was an anonymous location where we could sip coffee as crowds milled around us.
I was $40,000 in debt on credit cards when I got to DA, and I still had $35,000 in credit left that was free that I could use.
So the credit card industry had given you $75,000 worth of credit.
I had 35 credit cards. I thought it was a wonderful thing. I mean, my credit score was over 800. I had A1 credit. And
how much were you making at the time?
I was making $33,000 a year. So I owed more than my annual salary. So my first meeting date was July 13th, 1999. I will never forget that because I was terrified to go in. And the first 6 weeks, I think I cried at every meeting I went to because it was very painful. I didn't want to have to admit this was an issue that I couldn't deal with. Because I lived on credit cards for 25 years. You know, I mean, it took me a long time to hit my bottom, so to speak.
And how did you know when you had hit bottom?
I could not get through the month without doing a cash advance on some credit card to just meet my needs. I was not overspending, other than the way I'd run up my credit cards. I charged a car. I actually put a $4,000 car on a credit line. One of the problems with credit cards is when you've got that revolving balance every month, you keep thinking, I will pay it off, but you never do.
But slowly, she did. She paid off all $40,000 worth. Now she pays her bills in full every month. She has what Debtors Anonymous members call a prudent reserve. You'd call it a savings account or an emergency fund. But that's not all.
I have a retirement account, a mutual fund. I own my own condo. I own my car's paid off. These are things I did not have before I got into Debtors Anonymous. And I've learned so much. I write down this coffee we just bought. I have a receipt for it. It will go into my Excel spreadsheet. I track everything that I spend so that I can watch it. Spending money is a lot like eating. There's a lot of habit forming that goes on. And I've created habits for me that keep me in line that I didn't have before. I take money out every month that it goes into my savings. And I've budgeted myself enough that I have a clothing allowance. What I used to do is I would deprive myself saying, oh my God, I got to get these cards paid off. I'm not going to spend any money. And I'd go a couple of months and then I couldn't stand it anymore. So I'd go spend $400 at Macy's because I felt I deserve this. You know, so it was the imbalance of what I was doing that was also creating the problem that I had.
Do you own any credit cards? I mean, is this a matter of just not ever taking them out of the wallet, or are they completely cut up and gone?
They are completely cut up and gone. I have a debit card, but it takes the money out of my checking account, so I can't spend it if I don't have it. My credit went down when I first got into DA because I had to stop doing what I was doing. And so a lot of my creditors, I had to call them and say, I can only give you $10 a month. And some of them said okay, and some of them didn't. I had to deal with collection agencies. I learned a lot in doing a lot of that. But what I did was most of them took my $10 a month, and it took me 4 to 6 years to pay off a credit card. It's not a quick fix. No one's going to pop into this program and next year be okay unless they only owe a couple thousand, you know. But to me, it's like, you know what? I have to own responsibility that I bought this thing and I did not pay for it.
I think that's not the way a lot of people think about their use of credit cards, that when they plunk that plastic down, they have not paid for the good or service that they have.
That's exactly right. I used to think that way. There was a disconnect in my brain about when I bought something with cash and when I bought something with a credit card. For some reason in my mind, I had the thing or the service, whatever it was I paid for, and it was done. But I hadn't paid for it.
Is there anything about Debtors Anonymous that you think sets it aside from other debt reduction programs? What is it about Debtors Anonymous that you think really worked for you that maybe other things didn't?
It's a spiritual program. It built my self-esteem because we have a saying in the program, it's not about the money. That's one of the symptoms, but it's not about the money. And so you can fix the money all you want. If you don't fix what's going on inside of you, it's going to happen again. And I went into debt 3 times. First time I went into debt, I owed about $5,000, paid that off. Second time, $13,000, paid that off. Thought I fixed this problem, and then I got up to 40. So that's been the difference for me with DA, in that it's not just about the money. It's about what got me there. I'm a more peaceful person today. I'm a happier person today. I know how to live within my means, which is not a bad thing at all. In this country, that seems to be a terrible thing, to live within your means, and I don't think so. I still have fun.
And here's where I'd usually tell you to go to the website for photos and the like, but of course, we don't have any. We do, however, have a link to DA. You'll find it at marketplace.org. And stick around. We'll hear from another member of Debtors Anonymous in a moment. So, brand new college kid, do you want a credit card? One mom is surprised to find out her son's answer is no.
To him, debt is a trapping of an adult life, and you know how stupid adults are.
Hear what the family did instead, plus more on how recent grads are dealing with the recession. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. They graduated, they came, they conquered. That was the typical path of the so-called millennials, or Generation Y. But those 20-something-year-olds are also mockingly referred to as the entitlement generation, coddled children who grew up to be demanding employees. Well, in the first quarter of this year, they were hit with a 5% decline in jobs, the biggest of any age group, according to a Merrill Lynch survey. Gigi Duban reports on how recent graduates are adjusting their expectations and their egos.
Erin Mullaney is 26 years old, and career-wise, she's exactly where she planned to be. She's in a management-level position. She gets 3 weeks vacation, and her daily commute, 2 miles.
That looks lovely.
Thank you.
I like how you've coordinated all the colors.
Melanie works as the development director at a nonprofit agency in Birmingham, Alabama, serving low-income girls. She landed this job 6 months ago after what she considered a surprisingly long search.
I felt like, you know, I've had 2 years of experience. I now have a master's degree. And, you know, I probably sent out 30, 40 resumes in the area. I had one person tell me that they had 110 applicants for a development director position.
Now that she has this job, she's not about to do anything to rock the boat.
Am I going to go to my boss and say, you know, add an extra week's vacation, I need, you know, a raise? And no, I think everybody recognizes that now's not the time to to mess with your job security.
But wait a minute. Whatever happened to the so-called entitlement generation? They're the recent college grads who grew up with their parents praising every little accomplishment. They were told they could be anyone they wanted. Once they got jobs, they expected big raises and flex time and corner offices. Actually, Melanie is so uncertain of her economic future that she started a side business designing flyers and newsletters from home.
And all of that money is going straight into savings.
She's also traded expensive dinners and drinks with friends for game nights.
No.
One weekend a month, she and several friends get together at someone's house. First, they eat a spread of hot dogs, chips, and moon pies. Then they play Pictionary, girls against boys.
Banana!
Half moon.
Oh. Both are crescent moon.
Shoot, I chose the wrong one.
In spite of the small sacrifices, Melanie feels fortunate. After all, many others are still in search of their dream job.
Cycle, this is Aslera.
Aslera Vasquez is 26. She majored in music technology, but she's found it tough to find a job at a radio station or record label. So she took a job as a support analyst at a software company, mainly for the pay and health benefits. But there was just one problem. She dreaded going to work every day.
Coming in at 7 a.m., getting up before the sun is up, to me is depressing.
Almost 2 years into the job, Vasquez had been itching to leave. So last month, she says, her boss asked her if she really wanted to be there. Vasquez said no, and she was terminated. Now she's back to square one, networking and sending out resumes.
I didn't think I would find the job of my dreams fairly quickly, but I thought that I would at least get a job to where I can work my way up to the job of my dreams. That has definitely not been the case.
Experts say this economy has been a rude awakening for 20-somethings. And that's not such a bad thing, according to Jean Twenge, a psychology professor and author of the book Generation Me.
It does seem like, as the recession drags on, that you know more and more young people are having to adjust their expectations.
Twenge says that's partly because the younger generation now has a reputation for demanding too much too soon. But if you want to see an ego that's been seriously deflated by the economy, look at Aslera Vasquez.
I'll work my way up. I don't care if I'm buying coffee and doing people's dry cleaning as long as it's in the field that I want and as long as I get paid decent.
If the recession drags on for a few more years, Twenge says, we might see a real attitude shift in the entitlement generation.
On the other hand, I sort of suspect that as soon as we're out of this, the expectations and these attitudes toward wanting all of the perks and the praise and the time off and so on is going to come right back.
Twenge says it's a pretty deep-seated thing. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace Money.
Over the next few weekends, parents will be dropping their kids off at college. For lots of those students, it is their first foray out into the real world. They'll have to fend for themselves, making their own decisions like where to live, what to major in, and yes, how to pay for all of it. Harriet Brackey is one of those parents. Here's how she sorted it out.
Financial freedom? Well, that's a fine idea, but my son who starts college this year will not have that. I can't afford it. Have you ever seen how much an 18-year-old boy eats? But he has to have some control over money, and I was wondering how much as I drove to freshman orientation at Florida State University. I found plenty of other parents wrestling with how to handle a family over here and a student over there, hundreds of miles away, needing to buy something. So should I give him a credit card? Families I met at FSU had gotten credit card solicitations when the kids were in high school. No wonder the average college student racks up $2,200 in credit card debt by graduation. My son's response to the idea of a credit card was, no! He was a really good saver when he was younger, but when he turned into a teenager, he became just a fool with money. Surprising to me, at 18, he said he doesn't want debt. To him, debt is a trapping of an adult life, and you know how stupid adults are. Fine by me, then, no credit card. I noticed, though, that the parents of girls said their daughters were very much more responsible about money, and they would let them use credit. Good luck to them. I know mine, and he needs protection from himself. I was also amazed at how easy it is for a bank to get its hooks into college students. The school ID card that he needs to do anything is also a debit card for a bank. It turns out this isn't unusual at colleges here. So, we set up an account at the bank attached to his ID. He gets a debit card, a budget for mom, a charge account for books at the bookstore, and please buy them used, and a big, generous meal plan. He won't be hungry, but I was surprised that he's a little bit worried about money. He wasn't certain what all the rules would be at the bank, and he wanted to know every detail before he signed for a student loan. Now that's a good boy. He's worried a bit, too, about me and how I'll handle him handling money. Well, the actual money decisions are his to make now. I don't know how his limited financial freedom will work. I guess we'll both have more to learn. I just hope that the next time I see him and we talk about money, I won't be the one shouting, no!
Harriet Brecky is the personal finance columnist for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. We'd love to hear how you're prepping your kid for college. Write to us at marketplace.org. And now on to our second interview with a member of Debtors Anonymous. I met up with Ethan in another anonymous place on a hiking trail high in the Hollywood Hills. Again, we're using first names only. Ethan didn't join DA because of massive credit card debt. He simply found it impossible to manage his money. He was trying to run a fashion business, but it was taking a toll on his bank account and his sanity.
I've been in since 2001. I came in with $2,000 worth of debt. I had a company that I was a slave to. I was an under-earner. I worked way too hard for the level of money that I was receiving. And I was not big in the debt area. I wasn't someone who was using credit cards. For me, it was really about making sure I could spend money on things where there was a little bit more self-care. And I wasn't just paying my debtors and barely eating, which I did do. And that's what really brought me to DA.
What was the moment where you decided that this was something that you needed?
Well, I didn't know how to pay my rent, but I was working and overworking just to keep the business alive. You know, in Debtors Anonymous, there's the 12 steps. And the first step is recognize that we were powerless over something. And I felt really powerless over being able to figure out how to deal with my life around money. And so I knew when I first came in that there was help, that there was hope. When I got there, I could see people who had hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, and people who had all different levels of addiction that I didn't really fully share, but you know, I wasn't a big shopper. If anything, I just didn't spend money on myself. And that's something that I've gotten to learn about being in the program, which is really how to find some kind of equilibrium with myself and just be able to thrive.
So how did you manage your money or mismanage your money? I mean, did you even keep a running balance on your checkbook or...
I wasn't so on top of it. I think for me, the path was I was an under-earner. I worked way too hard for the level of money that I was receiving. And I had to kind of own up to that. And it took the support of people in the program and different, there's something called the PRG in DA, which is a pressure relief group one man and one woman, to be there to listen to you, to find out really, you know, where they can bring equilibrium to your world.
So what was your first PRG like?
I remember that I went in and I wanted them to fix what kind of work am I going to be doing right now, what's going to pay my bills, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And what really came back as feedback was, you need to slow down. Where are you taking care of yourself? And it was not what I expected, and not what I even necessarily wanted. But what it did was give me the perspective of, okay, I'm here for a long time.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about where we are. Why are we here in the Hollywood Hills?
This is a walk I like to take. We get a full view of downtown, all the way down to the beach when it's a clear day. And it's something about finding some kind of peace and perspective. And it's nice to be this high up and get a view of the whole city that normally we're just so run by.
Is this something you would have done prior to your experience with Debtors Anonymous?
I wouldn't have given this to myself, no.
Well, Ethan, thank you so much.
Thank you, and I'm just grateful that other people can have the opportunity to know about ways they can help themselves.
And stay tuned for our final Debtors Anonymous story in a bit.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for Getting Personal, where we answer your questions week after week. And Chris Farrell is here, as always, to offer some advice. So, Chris, let's go to Sarah. She's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm doing just great. I'm on vacation in Muskegon today, Michigan.
Okay, so you're on vacation, and yet you're taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, this problem is a big worry for me, so I'm happy to be able to get some advice.
Okay, well, how can we help you out?
My boyfriend and I are thinking about moving in together, and we both have properties. He has a condo in Ypsilanti, which is very near Ann Arbor, and I have a house in Ann Arbor.
At least they're not in Detroit.
Right, right. But, you know, everything in Michigan is affected by what's going on in the auto industry.
Yeah.
So his condo has lost a lot of value. In fact, now he's underwater in his mortgage.
And how about your property?
I'm not underwater yet.
Okay.
So we're trying to figure out what to do with his property. You know, we thought about renting it out, but with the mortgage payments, the association dues for the condo, and taxes, it's about $1,200 a month. But we think we could only rent it out for about $850 a month. So the question is, how long would it possibly take? Is it ever going to regain enough value for us to continue making these payments? All the rules are different now. I know this, but I have this whole thing about abandoning a mortgage that just gives me a big knot in my stomach. He's looking at it just like a business situation where does it really make sense to continue pouring $1,200 a month into a property that may never actually regain its value?
Well, what do you think, Chris? Go with the knot in the stomach or it's just a business investment?
Well, I'm going to lean with the knot in the stomach.
Yeah.
Michigan has unusually deep problems because of the problems in the auto industry. So that will continue to drag on that economy for a lengthy period of time. And I would lean toward renting it out, being a landlord, seeing what are the tax benefits, and seeing if that will work for you for the next couple of years, which is what it's going to be. It's going to be a several-year investment versus what are you going to do? You're going to walk away from the property?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, we've been looking at all the different options. You know, there's short sales and deed in lieu. And then the question is, you know, would the damage on his credit report, could we get out of it and recover from it sooner than we could regain the value? That's, I think, the fundamental question.
You know, my feeling is, look, you don't really want to be a real estate baron, but that's probably the right approach for you to take at this period of time. See what you can rent it out. Take a look at how you'll be after taxes as a landlord and what will be your real out of out-of-pocket costs on an annual basis.
All right. That's very helpful.
Well, Sarah, thanks for the call, and good luck to both of you in your moving in together.
Thanks so much.
Well, Chris, we have a very exciting development next up here. We have our first Twitter-generated question, which I don't know about you, but it makes me feel a little bit like a twit.
I would never think that about you, Tess, never. So I'm sorry. I'm just going to have to disagree with you there.
All right. Well, Jessica in Seattle wrote to us, since the limit is just 140 characters, her question is quite brief. She writes, what about those mortgage insurance products? $89 a month guarantees against income loss. Your thoughts. And I'd like your answer in 140 characters, please.
They're okay, but I wouldn't buy anything based on it.
Well done. Okay, I'm going to let you expand just because you did that so well.
So you are seeing more and more of this in terms of the mortgage insurance. If you go buy a home, some of the cars are offering a job loss insurance.
Right.
And, you know, Tess, it's not a case of bait and switch or these are scams or they're trying to take advantage of you. These are companies that are trying to burnish their brand name. Some of these companies are really out there trying to say, look, we are aware you're going to lose your job, so here's this product that we're going to offer. Like, for example, Hyundai has really improved its automotive image through its program. Now, here's my skepticism comes through. Is this really worth it? Well, if you're really worried about losing your job, should you be buying a house?
Probably
not. Should you be buying a car? Probably not, right?
Probably not.
Then there's the second part. All right, let's say you are in the market. If you are a buyer, boy, you have power these days. So forget about this insurance product. Forget that they're being solicitous. Get yourself the best deal you can. And you read the fine print and you go, eh, this isn't bad. Well, then, that's fine. But that's how I would approach it.
All right. Now, see, people, wasn't that fuller explanation more valuable than the 140 characters? Okay, I will try to be hip and happening and tell everyone that you can follow us on Twitter. Just type in Marketplace Money under the Find People section of Twitter.com. Otherwise, if you've got a financial question for us, just call and leave us a message, you know, the old-fashioned way. The number's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can send us an email, again, old-fashioned. You'll find the Getting Personal link on marketplace.org. And we will be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. Four years after Hurricane Katrina, everyone in New Orleans has a different idea of what safe means. For one family, flood protection means a tall, tall house.
My first livable floor is 11 feet above the ground.
I'll check in with Casey King and his new stormproof home, plus more stories from Debtors Anonymous. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and now to our final talk with a member of Debtors Anonymous. Bill has been in the program for the last 17 years. He's now on the organization's National Board of Directors. He agreed to meet in another anonymous place, a metro train stop in suburban Los Angeles, and he asked that we disguise his voice.
I came in with about $50,000 in unsecured debt. Had another $70,000 and a construction loan.
What made you finally decide that you had to take the step to go to DA?
Well, the telephone calls from the creditors and for not having been able to purchase anything else on credit because my credit was so darn bad. But most of the pain of not having money and savings and not being able to actually meet my obligations that caused me a lot of internal pain and made me feel like I was a nobody. We lived in an age where people who had credit cards could, you know, that was a status assigned to them then. It's not much of a status now, but during that time it was. And I'd get them and I'd max them out real quickly, even when I said to myself that I couldn't, that I weren't. So I knew I must have had a problem that was different from others.
What was your first meeting like?
I was very shameful because I have a degree in finance from a very good school. And I still couldn't handle my own. And so walking to that first meeting was pretty shameful. But because I had been in another 12-step program before DA, it wasn't probably as scary. You know, we borrowed the 12 steps from the Alcoholics Anonymous. I use deading the same way people drink. I just don't drink.
Do you find at all that there is a change in how people feel about admitting that they have debt problems? Because it's so widespread right now.
I would say in the rooms, yes. Outside of the rooms, no. Not as socially acceptable as Alcoholics Anonymous. Members of AA will talk about their time in AA a lot faster than they'll talk about their time in DA. I think debting is probably the course, the root of the problem. I heard people talk, share about their sex issues and all of those things before they talk about the money. Think about the friends you talk about. Very few of them will tell you what's really going on. Very few of them will tell you, hey, I bounced a check today. They won't come out and say that. Very rarely they'll say that to you. But they'll tell you, oh, my husband didn't come home last night, or my wife didn't come home, my wife drank too much, or I drank too much. Or they may say, I went to the game last night and got smashed. They didn't tell you they blew all their money. We as a fellowship should be the largest, and we're one of the smallest. Why? We get members from every other 12-step program. What did that tell us? That we all address all these other issues first. And debting is the last one we want to address because it's shameful.
What advice do you have for people who are in big trouble, money-wise, who are having trouble taking the next step and either going to a meeting or whatever else might work for them to deal with the debt?
I would say to them, don't be ashamed to say that you're a debtor. When I identify myself, say, hi, my name is so-and-so, and I'm a debtor, the recovery comes a lot faster.
That single sentence.
Yeah, the single sentence means you have surrendered. You no longer want to hide it. You know that that's what the case is, and you want to do something about it. The primary thing I would ask someone to do, listen to the winners in the room. Listen to somebody who's got recovery. Somebody that you hear you like what they said. Ask them, how did they do it? And then, secondly, get yourself a little spiral notebook and write down every penny that you spend out of your pocket. That's going to be the biggest lifesaver for you. And it's not a process that happened overnight, but it is a process. And the process means that it takes time. And you will be able one day to say, like I'm doing on this interview, that my life is so much better as a result of Debtors Anonymous.
Bill is still paying off about $9,000 worth of old credit card debt. Otherwise, the only debt he carries is a modest mortgage and a car loan. As I mentioned earlier, out of respect for the anonymity of these people, we do not have any photos for you on our website, but we do have a link to Debtors Anonymous and its 12-step program. It's marketplace.org. We are back with more Getting Personal, and our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here once again to take your questions. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Tess.
So Denise is on the line from Eagan, Minnesota. Hi, Denise.
Hi, guys.
So what's your question today?
Well, I left Minnesota state government 10 years ago, and at the time it seemed like the best thing to do just to continue paying the quite affordable life insurance that we had through the state. And I looked in the fine print and found that I couldn't go back to a term life policy unless I paid like a bajillion dollars. It would go from $386 a year to $386 a quarter.
Yikes!
Yeah. So then I looked to see what I could convert it to, and it said we can only convert to whole life, adjustable life, or variable adjustable life. And I'm sure we should just probably quit paying and find some other term life on the open market, but I wanted to make sure.
Well, what do you think, Chris? If they quit it right now, this term life policy, what does that mean in terms of any sort of payout?
Well, they're no longer covered. It's very easy to get lost in all the jargon of life insurance. There's all kinds of shades. And okay, so your basic is your term life insurance, and that's your pure death benefit.
Right.
There's your whole life. It's a savings account with life insurance.
Hmm.
And then there's your variable life insurance, and that allows you to invest in stocks, bonds, money market mutual fund. But here's my question I want to ask. Why do you need life insurance?
Well, we're 47. My husband and I are 47. We have three kids, one in college and one in middle school, one in high school.
Okay. Well, that's why you need insurance. You have kids.
Exactly.
All right. So that's your starting point. How much life insurance do you need? There are a number of good calculators on the web, like bankrate.com or Yahoo Finance. They have some very basic insurance calculators that can kind of give you an idea about, you know, your goals if something happened to one of you or both of you in terms of paying for college education, for example. You know, that kind of a thing. And that's sort of like your second part.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third part is, you'd mentioned, how do you shop for it in the open market? So there's a couple of good websites you can go to, like insure.com, insweb.com, and then you would compare that to making one of these conversions.
Great.
So does it help you out, Denise?
Yeah, it sure does.
All right. Thanks for the question. That was a good one.
Okay, thanks.
And next we have Catherine on the phone in Bellingham, Washington. Hi, Catherine.
Hello.
How can we help you today?
Well, I'm a high school teacher. I didn't have a lot of money when I was a kid, and I took out a lot of student loans to the tune of about $100,000.
Woo!
And I'm on the income contingent program right now, so I pay based on my income, which is great. I pay about $700 a month. So here's my situation. I would eventually like to get married in the next 2 years, in fact. But once you get married, you have to add your spouse's income on your report.
Hmm.
The person I'm with didn't know me in college and is not financially responsible for my debts.
Chris, is there a marriage penalty for student loans?
There is a marriage penalty with the income contingent plan.
Yeah. Mm.
So now it's based on household income versus just one or the other?
That's right.
Okay. Even if I filed separately?
Correct. With the income contingent plan. Now, there's a new plan that has gone into effect, and I know Tess has done a couple of interviews on it, called the income-based repayment plan.
Right.
Now, with the income-based repayment plan, if you are married but file separately, there is no marriage penalty. And as of July 2009, you can transfer an income contingent plan into an income-based plan. But before you run out and do it, married file separately, there's some penalties. There's some certain tax advantage strategies that are open to married couples that you won't be able to participate in. A classic would be the Roth IRA. It may be that you're worse off if you're married and file separately.
So you really got to make a list of pros and cons then and figure out what your priorities are.
Absolutely. But there is a way around the marriage penalty.
Okay. I have to say that I talk to my students about this every year, what really, really is financial aid and student loans, because I know that they don't get the education. I didn't get it, and I'm really paying for it right now.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for Getting Personal this week, but you can give us a call anytime. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or write to us. You can do that through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And on that site, you will also find Chris's blog, where he's got all kinds of answers for you on all kinds of questions. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This weekend marks the fourth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. About a year ago, I went to New Orleans and met with several families. We talked about what the storm had cost them in money, in time, and emotional turmoil while they waited for the government and insurance companies to keep their promises. In the Gentilly neighborhood, not far from Lake Pontchartrain, I found Casey King and his wife, Kathy. In our story last year, as we looked out onto his backyard, Casey described the damage from Katrina.
That's the London Avenue Canal levee wall.
You're living next to the canal.
Right.
So your house was fully underwater?
Yes, 9 feet for 15 days. So we decided to demolish, and we did that in June of 06.
The couple had been living out of an RV and a FEMA trailer for 3 years. The money to build a new house just had not come through. But since our visit, the couple went ahead and built a new place. They're pretty sure it can weather any storm. I spoke with Casey from his living room this week and asked him to tell us about it.
It's a different design. It's not your average house anywhere, let alone New Orleans. But we love it. It's got a kind of a nautical motif. We found a 40-foot mast over in Mississippi that had drowned in Katrina and pulled it out of the mud, and we're very delighted. It's painted blue and white with yellow accents here and there.
The issue that you and I discussed a year ago was the issue of elevation, placing your home high above the ground. Talk to us about what your house actually looks like right now. How far off the ground is it?
Okay, my first livable floor is 11 feet above the ground.
11 feet?
11 feet.
Boy, a year ago you were talking about 9 feet.
Things happen in construction. So, and that's, of course, the 9 feet was the high water mark for Katrina.
The vast majority of your neighbors built right back on the ground where their homes once were. They did not elevate.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. They did not elevate anything. And then of those that elevated, probably 85% elevated just to the legal limit.
How much did the house end up costing you altogether? And how much of that was paid for through FEMA grants and other government money?
Okay, altogether, I think we're looking, because it was a one-off design and caused a lot of confusion, I think we probably wound up paying over $300,000 for it. That was not the plan, but of that, about $170,000 was paid for by grants that we've received so far. We're still yet to receive what's called the FEMA Hazard Mitigation Grant, and that's, we anticipate, will be about $100,000. So given that, we'll have covered all but maybe $25,000 to $40,000. With government assistance, for which we are eternally grateful.
Yeah, you know, when I was there a year ago, your frustration was palpable. You were very angry at the time that it had taken for the government to get money to you. Now that you're in the house, has that subsided? What are your thoughts?
Well, it's the memory of the frustration is there, but at least it's not right in our face now. And the FEMA money looks like that will come along shortly, shall we say. I'm in a big hole for my life savings. Being retired, that's all there is. I'm hoping that the last bit dribs of money will kind of put me in at least an acceptable position from that standpoint. We're still have credit card debt that we never carried before, hoping that this additional money will come.
And again, just to remind folks, the levee is literally in your backyard.
Yes, ma'am. And it's the same as it was the day before Katrina.
Yeah.
In terms of maintenance and security. One of the things that's becoming very apparent, and I think we talked about it, is that there doesn't seem to be a concern on the part of leadership at all levels for the public safety element of flood protection. And so that's our latest crusade here, is to try and get people to make it a safety issue and trying to get them to use best practices. The tragedy of Katrina was we missed an opportunity when most of our housing stock was wet, soggy, flattened, and otherwise unlivable. We could have made a much better effort of protecting ourselves individually and as a community.
Let me ask you again the question I asked you a year ago, which is, why rebuild?
I'd have to say it's the culture of New Orleans. when we had the opportunity to decide where do we want to build, we really did want to come back and enjoy that culture. And from where we sit, that culture pretty much survives. What we were looking for is still here in New Orleans. And two, when I looked at taking the risks and the aid that might come, it looked like financially it would be beneficial. It just took 4 years to get that. So I, you know, if I'd known it was going to take 4 years, I probably would have made another decision.
Well, Casey, it's really nice to get an update from you. Please give your wife, Kathy, my best, and maybe we'll check in again in about a year.
Thanks kindly, Tess.
And we have photos of the King's new home on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, what living with less really looks like for working Americans.
The day after the company said they were going to cut our pay, I immediately dropped my contribution to my retirement fund down to zero.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our technical director this week was Ravi Karman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at Thrivent.com.
American Public Media.